I'm Marty Mosco, and welcome to The Connection. Eamon Dolan severed his relationship with his abusive mother when he was in his 40s. He had endured her physical and psychological violence as a child, and later her emotional cruelty. When he was an adult, he established a set of ground rules to prevent her from hurting him, but she broke all of them, and then he broke off all contact with her. Today on The Connection, Eamon Dolan tells us what it took to cut ties with his mother. His new book, The Power of Parting, is about how child abuse undermined his sense of belonging, his sense of safety and well-being into his adulthood, and how estrangement, while difficult to do, eventually set him free. He says that too often society is overprotective of the family as the ideal unit, putting abused children at risk for a life of psychological pain and even physical ailments. He argues that the mental health community tends to overvalue connection when disconnection can be the right thing to do. Well, today on The Connection, when family reconciliation was impossible. Eamon Dolan has been a book editor for 30 years. He's currently vice president and executive editor at Simon & Schuster. And Eamon Dolan, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
It's great to be with you. Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Would you have written this book if your mother were still alive today?
Yes, I would.
Why?
I got to a place in my life where it felt the most important thing to me was to share my revelation about the curative powers of estrangement with a lot of other people. My mother died in 2020, but if she were still alive today, I would want to tell people about my experience and to argue for estrangement.
Well, I have to say, the way you write about your childhood and especially the mistreatment by your mother, I mean, it felt as if you lived under a kind of reign of terror.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. One of the things I found during my research for the book was how similar abuse in families is to the way people in authoritarian and dictatorial regimes are treated. The tools are very similar. I felt, especially in retrospect, that living with my mother in my childhood and remaining connected with her in my adulthood were forms of incarceration.
So you felt as if you were a captive either at home or in this relationship with your mother. I mean, just so long as our listeners understand some of what happened to you, you were beaten, as you say, something like 3 times a week as a child. There was shaming.
On average.
So obviously more and less. Gaslit, undermined, criticized. I mean, it just felt like this sort of relentless level of psychological and physical abuse.
Yes, that's correct. I would say that I was beaten at least 1,000 times between when I was 4 and when I was about 14. And this is true for my siblings as well, my brother and sister. And then there were all the other forms of abuse you mentioned. And in addition, there was neglect. We weren't always fed properly. We weren't always clothed properly. And as you may get to in the course of this hour, neglect is actually the most common form and possibly the most harmful form of abuse.
What would set her off, or was that sort of unknowable as a child?
Yeah, that was hard to gauge. She had a lot of rules, and they were easy to forget. One that sticks in my mind to the present day is if we answered her with a yes or a yeah instead of a yes, mommy, we were in for it. There was an element of caprice. I think sometimes she would enforce the rules, and other times she might not enforce the rules. And that unpredictability, that uncertainty, that chaos was itself a form of abuse, I believe.
You mentioned that you had siblings, you had a brother and sister growing up. Did she treat them the way you did, or were they treated differently?
No, we were all treated the same.
Did you feel as if, you know, you were, in a sense, sort of prisoners together in the family? Was there some solidarity between you and your siblings?
There was. My brother Tommy was a year younger than me, and we were very close. We slept in the same bedroom, and we were the same clothes. We were the same size. My sister Jerry was 5 years younger, and my mother tried very hard to drive a wedge between Tommy and myself and Jerry, and she succeeded for a while until we all saw the light in one way or another.
You write about your father, who, as you describe him, was largely absent. He was either at work, he worked a lot, or he was in the garage doing things or tinkering, but sort of outside of the family. Did he know what was going on?
I believe he did. I also think he dissociated a lot. Both my parents were themselves products of abuse, and they responded in different ways. My mother, I'm going to go out on a very short limb and say my mother was had narcissistic personality disorder. She was a narcissist. My father took the opposite tack. He stepped away at every turn. As you say, he was out in the garage, or he was in the garden. We had a little garden in the back of our house in the Bronx, or he was, working his overtime. He routinely worked 12-hour shifts at the phone company.
Were you ang? I mean, as a kid, were you? What was your feeling? What were your feelings towards your father then? To be, to be your father, but also to be absent and in a sense, allow this to happen to his children.
Well, our feelings were tempered, and I would say skewed, in the way all children's feelings are regarding their home life, their parents. Kids are hardwired to think that however they grow up is normal. If they receive loving care, they think that's normal. If they are beaten, or otherwise assaulted or neglected, they think that's normal, and they think that they deserve it. I thought I deserved it. Into my 40s, until I started therapy.
Was there a place of safety in your childhood or a person who made you feel safe?
I had occasional interactions with other relatives, uncles, aunts, cousins, and I had my brother. I think my relationship with Tommy is probably a lot of what insulated me against the worst effects of my treatment in childhood. We were a band of brothers.
Yeah, a band of brothers. I mean, would you talk about your parents, or you just knew what the reality was?
We would talk about them, and we would strategize, about how to handle the next storm that we imagined might be coming. Sometimes we'd take the blame for something that the other brother had done in order to even out the beatings.
You mentioned your family, and you come from a large family, immigrants from Ireland, as a family of bystanders. So, did the larger family, did they know what was going on inside your family?
I found out in later years that they had inklings, or I would say even fuller knowledge than I ever imagined they did when we were kids. I never thought to question that. We never looked for help. Again, kids think that however they're treated is normal and what they deserve. But in once I started working on this book in particular, relatives of mine came forward, and I'm grateful that they did. They came forward to say, "We knew about this. In our culture, we either thought it was normal, or we didn't know how to intervene, or we did the best we could. We treated you well whenever you came over to our house." But that was I don't bear anger towards them. I am, as I say, grateful for the fact that they did at some point come forward and validate my truth.
You write about the extremes, the kind of silence, on one hand, and the violence on the other hand, and living in and between extremes is extraordinarily stressful and difficult.
That's correct. You never have access to any middle ground. In practical terms, you don't know, whether you're going to get dinner that night or what dinner might be. In emotional terms, you don't know Whether you don't know the middle ground, you don't know what it's like to be soothed. You don't know what it. You don't learn how to soothe yourself. You're in my, as I mentioned before, chaos itself is a form of abuse. And not knowing how my mother would be, whether she would be giving us the silent treatment or whether she'd be raging at us, kept us on edge constantly. And as I also say in the book, one of the things that puzzled me when I started doing my research and talking to other survivors was why the responses to abuse in childhood seem so different. As you say, silence or violence, but that's the sort of shorthand I use. Some people act out, other people act numb, keep it to themselves. And are stoic. And I realized that it was the extremity itself that was the common feature of our responses to abuse in childhood. We didn't know how to navigate that emotional middle ground, so we went to one edge or another.
Yeah, and I would think living under those conditions is a constant kind of vigilance. You have to be always sort of on guard because and surveying the landscape to make sure or to try to figure out, well, what's going to happen next.
Right, you're exactly right about that. And the term that's used in professional circles is hypervigilance. And I think that's one of the most common features, one of the most common tells that an adult might use to determine whether or not they experience childhood abuse is are they easily startled? Are there is their head always on a swivel, as they say in the military, looking for the next threat when there are no threats. It's adaptive when you're a kid, or when you're in battle and you need to be vigilant all the time. But it is, as they say, maladaptive. It's harmful, when the threats are no longer present.
We're almost up on a break here, but were there times when you and your family were out in public, maybe not with your extended family, where you looked like a normal, happy family, or you looked like a happy family?
I'd say we looked normal. I think happy might be overstating the case. I think to the casual observer, we'd look okay. To someone who might see us over a series of days or months, teachers at school, for example, or neighbors, they, I'm sure, noticed that we wore the same clothes, several days in a row, and just there are other tells that they would have noticed as well. I'm sure.
Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation. We have a lot to talk about, and that's Eamon Dolan, our guest today on The Connection. He's got a brand new book. It's called The Power of Parting, and it's subtitled Finding Peace and Freedom Through Family Estrangement. And he's talking about his childhood, and we'll be talking about how he finally broke his relationship with his abusive mother. Much to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. After enduring years of abuse by his mother, our guest Eamon Dolan decided to sever contact with her, realizing he needed to liberate himself from all that hurt and anger. And that's what he writes about in his new book called The Power of Parting. You have a section in your book where you're I think you're about 10 or 11, maybe 12 years old, and you decide to ask your mother if she loves you, something you had never heard her say. You describe this as a mix of masochism and curiosity. First of all, why did you want to know? Well, I guess every child wants to know, but what did she say? And what did that mean when she said what she said?
Well, I asked her for the reasons you just cited. Curiosity at the time, I didn't know from masochism then, but curiosity definitely swayed me towards taking the chance of asking her this question. I did know that it was risky to ask her, but I was curious. I'd seen, if you, I grew up in the Partridge Family era, the Brady Bunch era, and they're saying that to their kids all the time, and I heard, relatives say that to their kids. So I was curious. I asked her the question in the kitchen, and she paused and she really seemed to be thinking. I really thought that she might, that she wouldn't give the kind of reflexive response I'd expected, where she would just smack me. But she came out of her thoughtful moment, and she said, "I love you." And I really got kind of excited at this unsurprising turn of events. And then she said, "But I don't love the way you act." I'm using her Irish accent when I say that.
What did that mean to you?
It was extremely puzzling. If anything, it deepened my uncertainty about the nature of our relationship. It made me, I think, probably for the first time in my life, it made me philosophical. You know, how could you love somebody but not love their actions? Like that just didn't make sense to me. You can only know, even at 11 or 10, I thought you could only know someone by their actions, only judge them by their actions. So I was mystified.
Yeah, I think sometimes that's called a trauma bond, right? That there's this sort of mix of so-called love and violence, but it creates a kind of perverse connection.
Yeah, you're right. This was a trauma bond boiled down to one sentence. She was efficient that way. And trauma bonds, as you know, are a very common feature of the abusive relationship. The abuser gives the victim or the survivor just enough to kind of keep them coming back, but then always pushing them away again.
You mentioned the fact that she came from a large family. She and your brother, excuse me, your father as well, from Ireland, probably endured abuse themselves.
They did.
But why was she so, I mean, do you understand her cruelty? And as you say, she had siblings. They didn't beat their children. They didn't hurt their children psychologically. What was her impetus? What was her motivation?
Well, I don't know enough about her own childhood to give a categorical answer to that. I'll revert to the silence or violence distinction to suggest that everyone can react differently, but in ways that reveal patterns. Her way of reacting was, I would say, to take the self-hatred that she had gotten from her childhood, which she couldn't bear, which she couldn't hold within her, and pour it on to us. I mean, this is a very common feature of narcissistic personality disorder. They call it projection,
Right.
and I think projection is one of the most common features, where people take their own feelings about themselves that they can't bear, and as I say, put them onto other people, and then mask them with this sense of grandiosity and this sense that they, this unquenchable thirst for approval and compliments.
You write, "I'm comfortable feeling both compassion for how my parents suffered and anger for how they passed that suffering on to me." Sort of living with these sort of dual feelings, but feeling comfortable with that.
I have, it took me a while, but I have become comfortable with it. Part of it is just the serenity prayer. I like the wisdom to know the difference. I know what I can't control. I have to accept what was. And acceptance takes a long time. I don't mean it to sound like I just threw the acceptance switch and there I was. But a lot of thinking, a lot of therapy, a lot of talking to other survivors. That was this for me, this book was extraordinarily therapeutic, because I saw that I wasn't alone. I felt that. We shared our truth. I talked to at least 30 other survivors for the book. And again, the patterns were just everywhere. The way the isolation they felt, the discomfort they felt, but the idea that there was in our experience together, there was an explanation for why this could possibly happen that allowed us, and I think I can speak for the other survivors, a lot of them that I spoke with, that allowed us all to have a sense of, okay, there's a system here, a cruel system here that we are the survivors of.
Talking about feeling alone, you write that it really wasn't until high school that you felt that you had a friend in school. I mean, until then, you felt as if you were on the outside of all those children.
Yeah, that's right. And isolation, a sense of isolation, or actual isolation are other indicators of abuse. The abuser doesn't want your relationship with anyone else to be as strong as your relationship with them, your dependence upon them, your fealty to them. And that, so they drive wedges, try to drive wedges between you and your other siblings, between you and the neighbor kids. They, consciously or unconsciously make it difficult for you to assimilate into other communities. I don't blame the kids at my school. I went to the same school from 7th through 12th grade. So it wasn't until about 10th grade, as you say, that I started to finally worm my way into this social whirl there. And but I don't blame the kids. They weren't mean to me. They were just, I think they were just baffled by me. I was scrawny. I wore the same clothes day after day. I didn't really know, the little social niceties. And it took me, it took me a while, frankly, to, like an anthropologist on Mars, to pick up the cues and to learn how to integrate with the people who became my friends.
You say the beating stopped when you were about 14 years old. Was that just you were big then? You're just
Yeah, I mean,
harder to hit at that age.
she said, "Ah, you're too old to hit." She was, she was almost, she was lamenting that, I think.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Eamon Dolan, our guest today on The Connection. He's just written a new book. It's called The Power of Parting, Finding Peace and Freedom Through Family Estrangement. And he is talking about the really scary, violent relationship that his mother created with him as a kid growing up. He eventually did sever his relationship with her, which we will get to. I should add that he has been a book editor for something like 30 years and is currently vice president and executive editor at Simon and Schuster. Sort of fast forwarding into your adulthood, you write that you talk to her every day as an adult. And I was, based on what you said about your childhood, I was sort of shocked to read that. And I was wondering, did she call you? Did you call her? This was the obligatory phone call that if you didn't call her, you were in for it.
Well, I'd say if memory serves, I pretty much 92% of the time I called her, I would say. It wasn't so much, I mean, yes, she would heap guilt upon me if she didn't hear from me for, a couple of days. Why did you not check in on me? She but my as much as anything, so I had a sense of duty, I had a sense of obligation, as she reminded me often, I had only one mother. As we are told by so many forces in our society, we owe our parents some sort of special duty, regardless of how they treat us. So that's what I thought. I had drunk that Kool-Aid, like most other people do. I also felt it was a duty to my sister Jerry. She lived closer to my mom, and I think took the brunt of my mom's abuse as a result. And I wanted to, take some of that burden off her.
Your estrangement from her, I mean, and you mentioned the fact that you were in therapy, but it seemed as if your estrangement was a kind of a gradual thing. And you began to lay down some rules for her about what was acceptable and what was not acceptable. What was it like to do that when it felt to sort of take control of the relationship when it felt like she had so much been in control of your life?
Well, you're right about it being gradual, and one of the myths about estrangement is that the people who step away are impulsive or impetuous, and all the the abuser just said one thing and suddenly the survivor stormed off. It's almost never that way. It's always the result of a lengthy and torturous process. For me, the process began when my therapist and I were talking about these daily phone calls that you just mentioned. And she asked me this question that I never would have asked myself. She said, "What do you get out of those phone calls?"
Wow, such a good
And I
question.
said, yeah, it was a great question. And again, one that had never occurred to me. And I thought for a second or two and I said, "Nothing. Those calls aren't for me. I'm taking some of the weight off Jerry." And my therapist said, gently but firmly, she said, "You should not be in a relationship that gives you nothing." And that kind of started me down a long and twisty road. And of course, that is what propelled me, that realization, the acceptance of that realization that all relationships should be reciprocal, is what got me started.
Yeah, and as you write, these are sort of the rules of estrangement, if I can put it that way. Take a break, make a list, set rules, state the rules, be consistent, and parent yourself, right?
And I will say, I'll give myself some credit for accidentally stumbling upon what turns out to be pretty much the right
Right.
method, for figuring out, first of all, whether the abusive relative can change their ways, what they would need to do to change their ways, and if they can't change their ways, for you to then step away. I made a few mistakes along the way, but I got it again, to my happy, in I happily found out that I had done it pretty much the right way. And you just articulated perfectly the steps that one has to take.
Your book begins with your last phone call with your mother. Did you have that phone call thinking, okay, mom, this is the end, this is the last one, or was it just a moment sort of realization or revelation that this relationship is not going to change. I'm not ever going to get anything out of it.
It was more the latter. I did not pick up the phone expecting that I would sever ties with her that day. But as is often the case, with the inspirations for estrangement, it was a straw that broke the camel's back situation. She we it was a nice spring day. It was a Sunday afternoon, and I figured I could handle a call with her. And we made some small talk. And then one of my rules was that you couldn't say she loved to talk smack about people. She loved cruelty. She really reveled in it. And I just did not want that vitriol in my ears or in my life or directed at me. So she said something mean about, I don't know if it was about me or if it was about my sister or my aunt. And I reminded her of the rule. I said, you know, you're not supposed to say anything cruel or demeaning when we're talking. And if you can't follow that rule, I'll have to put some more distance between us. And she said, huh, I suppose I have to watch every word I say to you. And it hit me. And I said to her, you have to watch every word you say to everybody. That's just what good people do. And that was my aha moment. And I realized that she couldn't change. She was never going to change. I couldn't wait around for her anymore. So I told her that that was it, that we were done.
It's so interesting to hear you using her accent. I mean, this is a woman who was in your life for more than 40 years, probably in your head for more than 40 years as well. You also write about that. I mean, here, this woman who had just, sort of tortured you your whole life, and yet you felt grief, you felt guilt severing this relationship with her. How did you resolve that?
Well, grief and guilt are two of probably in fact, certainly the two most common results of estrangement, alongside positive stuff that I spend a lot of time talking about in the book, joy, freedom, peace, like I say in the subtitle. But the grief comes from the it's a different, it's an unusual kind of grief. It's its own kind of grief. Usually, when you're grieving something you've lost, something that someone that you loved and has left in one way or another. This is a grief for something you never had. To see other, my friends and their parents, or my friends with their kids, and to just feel a sudden hole in my heart, that would have been filled by that kind of a relationship. And, the one of the problems with our society is that it doesn't really have any structural support, any rituals to deal with that kind of grief. I mean, we're humans are great at other kinds of grief. We have Shivas, we have wakes, we have obituaries, we have Facebook pages, we have sympathy cards. But this kind of grief doesn't have any of that. In fact, I'm not sure how much sympathy there is. So it is definitely a process. It takes half a chapter to
Right.
talk through how to deal with the grief. And then the guilt comes from within, but it also is bolstered by all the social pressures to stay with family, even well-meaning friends. When they found out that I had stepped away from my mother, that I had estranged, were puzzled by that. They would say, what do you do at the holidays? Or what are you going to do when she's on her deathbed? All of these questions, which are well-meaning and totally understandable, but buttress this idea that I should feel bad about that.
And you don't. And we're almost up at a break here. I mean, you don't feel bad about that.
No, I don't. I feel proud. It was one of the three best things I ever did.
I'm proud because you did something to save your life, in a sense.
Yes, I took that very risky move. And also survivors, I mean, we to be raised in such inhumane conditions and to retain our humanity, that's heroic. I mean, the people I talked to for this book, they're every single one of them are heroes.
I'll tell you what, let's get back to that after this very short break. And again, Eamon Dolan is our guest today on The Connection. He's got a new book, The Power of Parting, Finding Peace and Freedom Through Family Estrangement. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be back in 1 minute. Stay with us. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Eamon Dolan. He has been a book editor for about 30 years now, and he's currently vice president and executive editor at Simon & Schuster. And he's written a book. It's called The Power of Parting, Finding Peace and Freedom Through Estrangement. Eamon, you mentioned the fact that, yes, there's guilt and there are other sort of more difficult feelings, but you also write about sort of how you learn to embrace joy and believe in happiness, that took some time to be able to experience what those feelings are all about.
Yeah, definitely. I will say the joy came surprisingly quickly, and the joy, I think, was a direct result of the freedom that I did feel free instantly. As hard as it was in other ways, I just felt like I didn't have to look over my shoulder anymore. I didn't have to clench my jaw. I mean, that's probably the most common thing I heard from survivors in the wake of their own estrangement is that word, freedom. And going back to what you said about, imprisonment, incarceration before,
Yeah.
it kind of makes sense.
Sure. When you feel as if there's a world out there that's yours to explore. I want to play a clip. Last year, I actually interviewed a psychologist, Joshua Coleman, wrote a book called Rules of Estrangement. And in his life, his daughter had actually severed her relationship with him. It was a sort of a point in their relationship that she wanted no parts of it. But he worked to repair it. And I just want to play a little section from that interview.
There was a period of time in her early 20s where she wanted to talk about the fact that when I got remarried and had children from my second marriage, how she felt in many ways displaced and unseen and kind of pushed to the side, and that the children from my second, which is my current marriage, I got a much better kind of quality of life, which is all I mean, that's certainly true. So, you know, when she went to talk with me about it, I think I was more defensive. I was more wanting to explain it. And I think she just felt misunderstood and like I wasn't really getting it and empathizing with her. And so she became more and more distant until she cut off contact. And it wasn't really till I began to just think that I have to, you know, do a much better job of just listening and not defending and not explaining and not getting upset and just empathizing and taking responsibility that things began to turn. And so we eventually did reconcile, blessedly, and are to this day.
Did you initiate then the reconciliation? Did you feel like it was your responsibility as the parent, even though she was an adult, a young adult, but as a parent, that you needed to try to figure out how to fix this thing?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, from the adult child's perspective, they're doing it because they feel like it's the healthiest, if not the best thing for them to do. So the adult child may not be nearly as motivated as the parent. For the parent, there's really no upside. It's all shame, loss, guilt, sorrow, regret, anger, feeling misunderstood. But for the adult child, there may be sadness, guilt, shame, etc. But they may also feel a sense of liberation and pride and strength in pushing back against the parent.
And again, psychologist Joshua Coleman talking about estrangement in his life. And, you know, Eamon, you just nodded your head when he said all the words that we have been talking about. But obviously in this relationship, the father in this case was willing to do the work, accept responsibility. I mean, something that it sounded like your mother was unable or incapable of doing.
That's exactly right. And I will say, I really admire Dr. Coleman. His book, which is aimed at the relatives who are abused from parents in particular, it offers great advice for them. And what he just said there crystallizes that. That is exactly how parents and other relatives in this situation should approach it. It is rarely how they actually do approach it.
You asked your therapist at some point, why am I not more screwed up?
I used another word besides
you did. I had to clean you up there for the radio. But I mean, I think we say, you know, hurt people. And while that can be true, the other truth is that most people who have been abused as children do not abuse as adults. I mean, they are at risk for it, but that they don't. So why were you not more screwed up, do you think?
I can't say definitively why. I can say a couple of things that probably contributed to it. As you say, you know, 60% of people or close to 70% of people who are abused don't abuse. So one thing is the fact that I had someone, my brother Tommy, with whom I could have a good, full relationship. He was what prevented me from complete isolation, and I'm extraordinarily grateful to him for that. I'd say I was lucky also in that I think for a lot of people I was lucky in that I had a great son of my own. Parenthood often shows people who were abused that they were abused. And it's a very visceral thing. I talked to a lot of survivors who had experiences similar to mine. They had kids and the kids, you know, would act out in various ways that all kids do. And they would remember what their parent would do in the same circumstance. And, you know, I said to myself countless times when my son was young, I can no more imagine raising my hand to hit him than I could imagine cutting it off. Suddenly, my mother seemed to me like this alien creature. And that idea, you know, I understand objectively how such things can come about, but to feel viscerally the wrongness of it had a very healing effect for me and does for other people. I talked with a wonderful woman named Darby Saxby at USC who does research on parenthood. And she confirmed this, you know, that she's done research that suggests that for a lot of people, parenthood is what she calls a third window. You know, we have two windows that we think of in terms of how we learn and how we become ourselves. One is 0 to 5 and the other is adolescence. And she's done research that suggests that parenthood is the third window. Suddenly you have to learn a whole lot of stuff really fast and your brain just becomes more malleable and more open. And it's a real opportunity for people to figure out their abuse, but become more themselves just in general.
Well,
I think that was for me too.
Yeah, and you mentioned this word earlier, reparent. I mean, did you have to sort of take, you know, young Eamon Dolan and sort of parent him as the older version of yourself, so that you could maybe give him a better childhood?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Or at least help him understand the reality of his childhood. You know, I talk a little bit about internal family systems therapy,
right.
And there are other forms of therapy. It's all acronyms all the time in the therapeutic world: AEDP, CSRT.
Yeah.
But they're thinking about addressing the parts of you that still reside within you and still feel the way that they were made to feel when they were 7 or 9 or 11, and addressing those parts often directly, like imagining them in the room with you and talking to them and telling them, this was not your fault. You are not a bad person. No 9-year-old is inherently bad. This was your mother, my mother, our mother was the bad person. You were a good person, and you're going to have a good life. You're going to have a son of your own who never gets beaten. He gets the food that he likes, and you're going to have a good job and good friends. You know, all of that stuff that nobody told them, nobody could tell them to a certain extent, but just the basic fact that you're good and you don't deserve it.
I remember hearing someone say, it's never too late to have a happy childhood. So, I mean, in a sense, you can sort of, you know, make one for yourself out of the sort of shards of your actual childhood. I mean, I'd love to have you read, and this is tough stuff, but nonetheless, the eulogy. Your mother died actually early on in the pandemic.
Right.
And this is the eulogy that you did not deliver at her funeral, but it's in the book here, and I wonder if you could read it for us.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. And this came out of one of the great things about this experience of writing this book for me was talking with other survivors and hearing about the ingenious ways they invented to deal with their trauma and to get past it. Because I don't know if we'll get to it in this hour, there really aren't very many good ways in the therapeutic realm for dealing with this. A lot of therapists don't really know about it. So a lot of people have to invent their own healing. So one of the women I talked to, I call her Ellie in the book, she had estranged from her very cruel father, but somehow got shoehorned onto the program for his memorial service. So what was she going to say? And she decided with great trepidation that she would tell the truth. And she told the truth, and she was scared of doing it. But people came up to her afterwards and said, I didn't know you could tell the truth at one of these things.
Wow.
So I was telling my therapist about that, and I said, I wish I could deliver that kind of trilogy from my mother. And she said, do it right now. So I thought for a second, and this is what I said. Friends, I improvised. We are gathered here today to celebrate the passing of Teresa Dolan, who was awful. The world is a happier place without her. Everyone here experienced some of her cruelty, so we all have cause to rejoice in the fact that she has finally left us. And we should all feel proud that we didn't let her cruelty rub off on us. I am especially proud of myself and my beloved sister Jerry and our dearly departed brother Tommy. She was cruelest of all to us. She beat us, she insulted us, she gaslighted us, and she neglected us. She tortured us every day we spent with her. Even talking to her on the phone was harmful to us. If we weren't her children, what she did to us would be considered criminal. But somehow we survived her crimes with our humanity intact. So please give us a round of applause.
Feel good to write that?
Yeah, felt good to read it just now too.
And felt good to read it. Is there anything, dare I say, this is the wrong word. Is there anything you miss about your mother?
Honestly, I don't think there is.
Yeah.
I miss having a mother, a
Yeah.
good mother. I really don't miss her. I felt, even though I had been estranged from her about 8 years when she died, it felt good when she died.
Yeah.
I got the news a little bit before my sister did, and I called Jerry to tell her, and she said, "Ding dong, the witch is dead."
Yeah, I
And
went,
that's how we
ouch, when I
felt.
read that. Yeah. But that tells you, I mean, this was your reality. This was your life.
Yeah, exactly.
You quote Bessel van der Kolken, and he's, famous writing "The Body Keeps the Score," but we've been focusing so much on your the psychological part of being a child that endured abuse. But he writes, and you quote him here, "Hiding your core feelings takes an enormous amount of energy. It saps your motivation to pursue worthwhile goals, and it leaves you bored and shut down. Meanwhile, stress hormones keep flooding your body, leading to headaches, muscle aches, problems with your bowels or sexual functions, and irrational behaviors that may embarrass you or hurt the people around you. Ignoring inner reality also eats away at your sense of self-identity and purpose." And I think in many ways that really just encapsulates what we have been talking about. But the sort of physical manifestation when someone is dealing with the sort of level of psychological abuse and neglect that you've been describing is really extraordinary.
It is. There should be more research on this, and there are reasons I go into in the book as to why this country lags behind other countries in this regard. But the re but it is certain that the childhood abuse and neglect, even if it's not physical abuse or sexual abuse, causes physical or can often cause all those physical symptoms that you talked about in adulthood. All abuse becomes, or most abuse becomes physical at some point. One of the things I suggest in the book is that those forms that you fill out whenever you go into a doctor for a checkup, they always ask you about, how many drinks you have a week and if you've ever smoked and what drugs you take. The first question on those forms should be, were you abused or neglected in childhood? Because the effects are so common and can be so serious.
I mentioned this in my introduction that something like 25% of children report either abuse or neglect at some time in their lifetime. And many people feel as if this is an undercount. What do you
Right.
hope? What do you hope your book does?
I hope a couple of things. I hope that it alerts people to the extent of this problem, to the to the, I mean, there are after the book went to press, new research came out from Josh Coleman, who you quoted from before, saying that suggested that up to 50% of people were estranged.
Wow.
So estrangement is, for one thing, it's much more common. For another thing, it can be the most healing thing you can do, getting to a place of safety and then becoming yourself. Estrangement is a necessary path for a lot of people. Another thing that I want the book, and I want to help people in practical terms. As you said before, there's a lot of how-to in there. Based on my own experience and based on talking to a lot of other survivors and experts, on how to deal with all the emotions, positive and negative, and how to, get rid of the inner critic that can be so debilitating for us. And the last thing I'd say is I want people to change their definition of family. We think blood is thicker than water. We think it's all about genetics. In fact, we humans have this amazing capacity to make family out of any group of people we find ourselves with. I mentioned band of brothers before. That's a phrase they used in the military. Soldiers become closer to each other than they become to their own birth families. You see this in monasteries, you see this in fraternities, you see it in kibbutzim, you see it all over the place. We can make families that help us and support us and love us.
Well, Eamon Dolan, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. Really appreciate the book and you being part of this conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Eamon Dolan's book is called The Power of Parting, Finding Peace and Freedom Through Family Estrangement. The Child Help National Abuse Hotline is 1-800-4-A-CHILD. In Pennsylvania, call the Child Line toll-free at 1-800-932-0313. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and today on The Connection, our engineer has been Al Banks. The show produced by Debbie Builder with Paige Murray-Bessler. Thank you so much for joining us.